From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. He was 17 before he read a novel cover to cover. Now, New York Times bestselling author Jason Reynolds hopes to make reading a little cooler for kids. Inspired by hip-hop and real-world issues, his books connect to the complexities of young adult lives. He's in Georgia for a reading this coming Monday, but we're catching up with him first from our studio in Washington, D.C. Hello, Jason.
How are you?
I'm very well and excited to talk with you. What was that first book that you read at 17?
The first book was Black Boy by Richard Wright. And, you know, it's one of those things where a teacher's kind of like, hey, read the first five pages, and if you don't like it, you can close it up. Of course, on the second page of the book, the main character burns his mother's house down. He sets the curtains on fire and basically burns the house down.
And for so a young he had person, you. Say,
exactly. That was it, right? It's like, oh, this is amazing. I'm all in, you know.
So I also read that you were reading poetry when you were a kid. Poetry?
I loved poetry. But before poetry, it was rap lyrics. I would read the liner notes of cassette tapes of my favorite rappers, you know, Queen Latifah and Tupac and Slick Rick and all these teenage geniuses, you know, and I'm reading their rap lyrics and I'm realizing that there's a direct correlation between what they're doing and the poetry that we're learning in school, that this is poetry too. And that was sort of the entree into the world of poetry. But I loved it. I loved Nikki Giovanni and Langston Hughes and all of the sort of poets of the Black tradition.
So were your friends reading poetry too?
No.
Would you tell them that you were?
Yeah, for sure. I didn't, you know, I was fortunate to grow up around a bunch of guys that I love dearly and that kind of respected whatever it is we all chose to do. It's kind of, we're all very different. So they were okay. They didn't understand it, that's for sure. But they were like, all right, Jay's doing whatever Jay does, you know.
Well, you grew up in D.C. in the 1980s. This is a time of big social changes, big hair, and big social problems. What was it like for you?
I mean, you know, I think it's one of those things where when you're a kid, you don't always understand everything, right? If you go to your grandma's house in Northeast D.C. and your cousins are there, you don't know why people are acting the way they're acting until you're a little bit older. But then you realize that there was, you know, you have to deal with the crack epidemic, or my next door neighbor who unfortunately died of HIV, or my friend's uncle who died of AIDS. We were around it all the time. And then you also had rap music, right? It was everywhere. This new music that all of us had grabbed the hold of, it was a big deal. But these are the things that were happening. And these are the things I would have loved to have seen in books just because they were familiar, you know?
Well, right. And you were hearing these things reflected in hip hop, maybe, but not necessarily in books.
No, not in books. I mean, if you were raised in the 1980s and in the early 1990s, all of the books that you were reading were pretty much based in the 1970s and the 1960s. What would have been helpful is if we had hyper-contemporary works that were, they're not just reflected our realities, but also that was written with our linguistic texture, right? I needed to hear my voice. I needed to hear the details of my language in the stories, and that wasn't a thing at the time.
So you didn't have those books at that time. Who would you say is your target audience now?
My target audience, you know, if you are 8 years old, all the way up to 25, you're my target audience. But also anybody, I try not to limit it. I think we all could use a good story. I think we all could use a conduit to empathy and a conduit to understanding, and that doesn't have an age limit on it. But for young people, I want them to know that they're valuable. And so in order to do that, I try to create works that reflect their realities as they are living them, so that if you feel alone in the space in which you reside, you know you need not feel alone, because these books can serve as reminders that it's not just you.
Well, if you're looking at a, you know, classical YA audience, you've got the sort of tweens and, as you said, up to 25, but a lot of them focused on middle school kids. This is a time of life that a lot of us want to forget. Why did you decide you wanted to write for that audience?
I think that those young people are at the fork in the road. I think they are at sort of this interesting precipice, and what happens to them in seventh and eighth grade, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade could affect their lives forever. It doesn't have to, right? They don't have to necessarily cling to whatever story is given to them at 12 years old. But it does matter that at that age, as they start to form opinions about the world around them, that there is something there to remind them that their opinions are valid, mm-hmm. right? And that their experiences are valid and valuable, and that they're not half-formed things, right? They are whole people. Just young, but they're whole people moving through the world at 11 years old, and we have to honor that.
Yeah, and what I see in them is this kind of awareness of self, or dawning awareness of self, and trying to balance that with the rest of the world. And something that I see running through your books, expectations that parents have, that communities have, either low or high. I'm thinking especially of Sonny, because I just read that. His dad wants him to be a marathon runner. He wants to be a dancer. How does he navigate that?
His navigation through it is complicated, because this is his father. And young people feel this way all the time, that there are things that they perhaps want to do that their parents don't necessarily see as viable, right? Or see as real, or as authentic, or as safe. And also, we have to remember that adults, we have our own baggage, and we bring that baggage to every space that we step into, even when it comes to the raising and the rendering of our children, right? Like, when we are raising our kids, that doesn't mean that we shirk off our own baggage before we begin that process. And so what you see in Sonny is his father projecting, and his father not being able to deal with his own pain. And so Sonny has to bear that weight until Sonny decides not to. And he just says to himself, look, this is what I want to do, and I have to make this decision for me. I can't live for my parents anymore. And I know that that's really hard in real life, but that's the reason why I put it in a book, so that young people know that at some point you may have to make that decision.
I'm speaking with the New York Times bestselling author Jason Reynolds. He writes books for young adults that aren't fantasies, but grounded in real world challenges. Most recent is called Sunny. He's also got a more recent nonfiction book called For Everyone. Well, Sonny is also the child of privilege. So this bucks against, you know, this kind of idea of, you know, being raised in an underserved community as an African-American young boy. Why did you bring that in? Why was that important to you in this book?
Because I think that there's always such, our experiences have been whittled down to a sliver, when really we aren't monolithic people. We are polylithic people with multiple slivers of culture, and all of us, you know, we all share certain things, but we also, there are a lot of things that we don't share. And Sonny is real, right? The reality is there are a lot of Black kids who are wealthy, Black kids who are privileged and who are resourced. That's a reality. And we never get to hear that story. Does that mean that their lives are better? Perhaps in certain ways their lives are made easier, but there are other issues that come into play that still affect them, and that still sort of have to be worked through. The other thing is that I think that the Black child has to be able to be all the things. When we talk about freedom and liberty and all these things that we sort of tout all the time in our country, what we don't always talk about is how the what freedom actually is the ability to be whatever it is that I want to be, even if that means not being the coolest kid in school. The Black kid is always seen as either the toughest kid or the coolest kid. Hmm. The truth is that Black kids can be weirdos, too. They can be counterculture and misfits, too.
A lot of YA books, you get, you know, not that range, but you get the post-apocalyptic kind of fantasy book. You know, I'm thinking of The Hunger Games as stamping it. Do you ever get tempted to try that route?
Not really, no. I mean, it's curious. I'm curious about it. But I, I don't know if my colleagues who do that, I have utmost respect for them. There's a certain level of imagination one must have that I'm not sure that I have yet. And two, I don't know if I can suspend reality in that way. I think that the world we live in is magical enough. I just think we have to pay attention to it in a different way.
You talked about hip hop as one of those pillars, one of your inspirations. And how do you translate that into books, into reading?
I think a few ways. Number one is language. I think that the beauty of being raised at the boon of the hip hop era, the boon of hip hop culture, is that when hip hop evolved, it over time became it basically just became youth culture around the world, which started out as a segment of Black culture, specifically urban Black culture, grew up and became worldwide culture of all young people on Earth. And so the beauty of that is that language is the language I naturally speak. So I have an in. It's like having a golden ticket into young people's sort of psyches. And so the first thing is language. I try to be honest with language and fool around and play around and be playful and loose with language on the page, because that's the way that we speak. We're not robots. We're not, you know, I don't speak as a poet. I speak as a person. And I think I want to put that on the page. The second thing is rhythm. Those books, if you read them aloud, they're written with a certain kind of rhythm. And I don't know, and it just comes naturally to me, because that's the way I was introduced to literature, was through rhythm, was through music. By the way, that's how we all are introduced to literature.
I mean, right, we learn the alphabet. La-di-da-di-da-di-da.
Right. With the alphabet song, right? We all learn everything we learn about literature or about language or about phonics. We learn through song. We learn through rhythm. We learn through nursery rhyme and all these other things. So it's natural for me to take what I learned from hip hop and to transfer that into the page.
Well, rhythm, of course, is the language of poetry. And you, your most recent book, For Everyone, is written as a poem. And after, you know, being recognized with huge awards, your most recent book, For Everyone, is about the pain of not hitting it out of the park. It's a real departure. What has the response been from readers used to your YA fiction?
It's surprisingly been overwhelming. I wrote For Everyone when I was 24, and when I was quitting and felt defeated and wasn't certain that there was space for me in the literary world. And this was sort of my way of licking my wounds. This was the only way I knew how to communicate to myself. This medium, this art form that I'd studied and sort of cleaved to for 20 years at that point, I needed more than ever because I felt defeated. And so I started writing For Everyone. It took 3 years. And over the course of that 3 years, it went from a licking of the wounds to more of a better understanding of what the process is and what the journey is. But instead of writing a journey is the destination book, it's more about saying, look, I don't have any answers because I don't know. I have the same problems that you have. I don't know how to make this thing happen. I don't know how to find success. I wish I could 1+1 it for you. But the truth is that I am not an expert on life. What I do know is that you aren't alone. What I do know is how it feels to want something battered and breathing. I know what that feels like. And that's sort of where For Everyone came from. It's kind of weird to read it and then see it out in the world because I wrote it 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. and we didn't edit it. We just kind of left it as is, as my 24-year-old voice, and put that into the world. And so it's kind of cool that people like it, but it's kind of cringy for me, you know?
So, Jason, I mean, if you had a magic wand, what would you change about how literature is taught in schools today?
I don't believe, and this is, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I haven't, so forgive me, I haven't quite fleshed it all out, but I do want to sort of pose this. If language is a living thing, right, which we all can agree on, language is living, it is changing, and it is evolving, just as human beings are living, changing, and evolving, then we should not be reading the same books. After a certain amount of time, there needs to be, like, waves have to go in and out. I don't want, like, as much as I love Sunny and all of the books that I've been able to write, if 40 years from now they're being taught in schools, I failed. Hmm. I failed, right? The truth is that the idea of timelessness is interesting because I want to write something that's really timely, really now, like right now. And I want it to work to affect change right now. And if that means that I sacrifice the timelessness of that book, I'm okay with that.
Jason, I have to stop you there because we have run out of time. It's the reality.
I'm sorry.
But I thank you
okay.
so much for speaking with us.
Oh, good. Thank you very much.
New York Times bestselling author Jason Reynolds. He's going to be in Georgia for a fellowship at Air Serenby and is reading at Eddie's Attic in Decatur on Monday, June 11th. Details at gpbnews.org. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Lauren Groff never thought she would become a Floridian, but then she never expected to be name-checked by a president. In 2006, she moved to Gainesville for her husband's business. 9 years later, President Obama called her novel, Fates and Furies, his favorite book of the year. Groff is out with a new book of short stories called Florida, and the state that she creates is not a punchline, and it's not populated with trailer parks and retirees. We spoke with Lauren Groff before her reading at SCAD Show in Atlanta. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
So glad you're here. These 11 stories in Florida, they look at the state across time and geography and development booms and the disappearing natural world. What is it that you find most interesting about this state that you now call home?
I am so ambivalent about Florida. So I both absolutely adore it. I go for a run every single morning out in the prairie, and I see sort of the natural world, and I can, you know, there are always snakes underfoot and amazing birds that I wish that I could identify sort of landing in the trees around me. It's very stunning and beautiful, and there's a pour of sunshine over everything. But there is, at its heart, a very central strangeness. It's very swampy in its interior, Florida. And the natural world here, too, is both perilous, but also it's a gift. And the thing that I was looking at when I was trying to figure out how to put this story collection together was how do I look at Florida itself? What do I think of the name Florida? What does it mean to me? And it means pervasive, ongoing dread. covered in sunlight, in golden, beautiful, stunning sunlight. So
I'm guessing Florida Tourist Board is not going to make you its spokesperson.
Well, perhaps they will if they want to make Florida even weirder than it is. Yes.
Well, there is this sense of danger underfoot, especially in places where humans meet the natural world. You know, there's like a snake coiled in the bathtub and an alligator not far from the dog pen, a sinkhole at the edge of the suburb. Does it feel like that to you, that you could just slide into some other realm?
It does feel like that to me, but it also feels like that in terms of being a parent in today's world to small children, right? I mean, I feel like just the act of having a child in the world is an act of danger, right? Because suddenly you have this heart taken out of your chest and made manifest in the world, and you can't control the world around your child. So I do think that that's the way I feel about the state, but it's also the way I feel about, you know, being a human in this current environment that we happen to be in right now.
Well, the danger of children is, it seems like part of the theme here. There's a story, Dogs Go Wolf. It's about a pair of young sisters. Their mother, all adults, abandon them on this island. And at first, you know, it's fun. There's a big sister making up stories about princesses, but eventually they're eating chapstick to survive. You are a parent, but you're also a big sister. Was that your role with your little sister, kind of keeping her going?
This story did come out of a moment in my life when my sister was having a hard time, and I kept thinking how I could protect her. I mean, she's an adult now. She's in her mid-30s. She's a two-time Olympic athlete. She's fine. She doesn't need me to protect her. But this is also something that I've been thinking about a lot about the world in general is how do we take care of the most vulnerable among us? I mean, we have to take care of the vulnerable people in our world. How do we do so? How do we make sure everybody is able to survive? How do we do these things? So the sense of peril comes from a larger, almost existential idea in that story.
Well, her answer to vulnerability is fantasy. And I can't help but think of Florida as Disney princess land. Did you have those kind of fantasies? Did you make up those kind of stories when you were a kid?
No, I've never liked princesses. I've always hated the whole narrative of the princess, because the narrative of the princess is your life basically ends as soon as you find love, right? I mean, it's almost as though a woman only exists in order to be an object of love or to have a love story. When in reality, I mean, I have an older brother, and I saw that he wasn't fed these narratives. He was fed the narrative that you go out and you have your adventure, and your life is your adventure, and I resented the idea that my life would end as soon as I found love. So I actually truly dislike a lot of the narratives that we are force-fed and that we actually take in with, you know, our milk, with the media all around us. And I think one of the things that this collection does is that it opposes a lot of these narratives about what it means to be a mother and to seize that space, what it means to be domestic or domesticated, what it means to sort of resist the wild, but while also tempting the wild in. You know, I hate the cowboy mythos. I hate princesses. I hate the things that we are told that are skeletons of our narratives. And as we all know, narrative is the most important thing. If you control the narrative, you control everything. Right now,
you're reminding me of an appearance that I saw of you from 2016. This was on the Charlie Rose Show. Charlie Rose, we know what has happened to him since. But I just want to play it because it's pointing to something that you're talking about.
She had so much rage, right? So much rage. And I see this in myself, and I see this in a lot of my friends,
too. What did you
have
rage about?
One thing
you have rage about.
Well, it's not so much that I am unusual in my rage. It's that women are not necessarily allowed access, open access to our fury. Yeah.
Wait, stop.
Yes.
Women are not necessarily allowed open access to their fury.
Right.
Tell me what that means.
A bit of a pause there, Lauren Groff.
Yeah. Okay. I have so much to say about this.
Was that a gasp?
Also, he talked over me that whole thing. But I would like to say I have felt guilty about this interaction the whole time. I was playing nice, and I was being a nice guest. And I could have just said, women have so much to be angry about. I mean, when we make 75 cents on the man's dollar and less for women of color, when we have to fight every day for our bodily autonomy, when we have lack of representatives in politics, in business, on the Supreme Court, I mean, everything. We have everything to be angry about. And yet I failed. I failed all feminists by not saying these things to Charlie Rose and by not standing up for women at that moment. So I feel very ambivalent hearing that clip.
Well, you just got to make it up, right?
This may not be
Charlie Rose's audience, but besides being in the position of women-splaining female rage to Charlie Rose, when you heard about the accusations against him, did you have any perspective on the way that he understood or maybe thought about women?
No, because he was kind to me, right? He was being very nice. He did interrupt me, you know, and I think I am more used to that than a man would be. I don't have any perspective on him. I'm sad because I like to watch his shows, but I believe women. You know, you have to believe women these days, and we have to all be allies to each other, men included. In fact, men need to step up and start being better allies.
We're speaking with Lauren Groff. She's out with a new collection of short stories called Florida. Well, there are women characters, in fact, one that seems to pop up, a mother of two, like you, and a writer, not originally from Florida. So her feelings about the South seem pretty ambivalent, as you said, you feel about Florida. What do you think it is that most people, Southerners included, even here in Georgia, don't get about Florida?
I think there's a lot of contempt about the state and the people who live here. And I'm not quite sure I know where it comes from. I think part of it is just the fact that we sort of dangle off the rest of the continental U.S. We are the most south you could possibly be. And there are a lot of overriding narratives that are just insane. I mean, people talk about Florida as though it's God's waiting room because there's so many old people. And they talk about Florida in the context of Florida Man, you know, the person on Twitter who every time something bad happens in the U.S., some guy walks into a store and sticks up the store with, like, his banana. That comes from Florida, right? And so the perception is that Florida is kind of ridiculous. And I don't think it is. I think it's really interesting. I think it's there are parts of it that are hilarious and strange and unusual. But there's a lot of contempt that I guess I had to get over myself as a transplant. And I think that a lot of other people, even other Southerners, hold in their hearts for Florida.
Not projecting that this woman is you because she's a writer and she has two kids. But the last and the longest story, this woman comes back again. And she's traveled to France in this story. And it's there that she disappointedly realizes she may belong in Florida more than anywhere else. What is drawing her back there?
Right. So this character is not me. And I did have an experience. I took my own two little boys to France when they were 6 and 4 by myself, which I would not make my worst enemy do that. It's a terrible thing to do. We had some fun. But I did realize halfway through that where my children are happy is where I need to be now. And it seemed like it was both clarifying but also deeply dispiriting, because I do value autonomy and independence so much. But when you're a parent, you don't necessarily get that choice, and you shouldn't necessarily have that choice all the time. So it was an intensely complicated moment in my own personal life and also the life of the character.
She says, of all the places in the world, she belongs in Florida. How dispiriting to learn this of herself.
Right. I mean, there are days when I think, you know, I could wake up in Paris. I could wake up in Tuscany or in Japan and have a different life, but I would carry myself there. And I am this almost 40-year-old person who has so much baggage. You can't get away from your own baggage. And Florida is everywhere now. Wherever I go, I am in Florida.
You're reminding me of this kind of multiple perspectives, the voice of a character, right? In Fates and Furies, this was a he said, she said, opposite sides of the same story, telling their story of their time together, not necessarily the same at all. So that's not something that, you know, you're going to be able to do in another novel. you've kind of done that one, right? And the surprise is there. But most of the stories in Florida do have one voice, but it allows you to tell stories from countless perspectives. So how do you get inside the heads of so many different characters?
So in a novel, it's just something that you apply yourself to very calmly on a daily basis. And eventually there's accumulation of pages and attrition of fear, and you have a thing. But with short stories for me, they're closer to poetry for me. So they come out in this ecstatic burst, and usually they come out multiple times. One time in an ecstatic burst, and I look at it and I think, this is terrible, I throw it out. And then I put it back into the subconscious to be embroidered upon for years, and then take it back out again when it feels necessary or urgent. So it's really just the process of writing a short story. They come out over the course of years in which, you know, I've thought through these characters really deeply. But that's the beautiful thing about representing a state like Florida that actually cannot be pinned down because there's no single reality. You can do it in short stories because you can do it in a multiplicity of voices and a multiplicity of characters and still feel like you're saying something about a state, that geographical state, but also a psychological state.
You said something about putting it back in the unconscious. Is there a process for that, or you just sort of, you know, put it down there while you're doing the dishes or making dinner or something like that?
Yeah, no, the process
I'm sorry,
is really...
those were totally gendered examples, by the way.
Yeah, no, my husband does the dishes, by the way. I don't... It's not conscious, right? And I think that when we are receptive to our subconsciousness as artists, that's when the really good work happens. So I think that a lot of times I really do just throw out all my drafts. So if I were to do a story, throw it out, throw it back into the subconscious, and let it sit there, if it ever comes out again, it needs to be told. If it doesn't come out again, that's fine. It didn't need to be told, right? Mm-hmm. Or I haven't yet found the way to tell the story that I wanted to tell. So it's more about keeping things mysterious and opaque rather than forcing them into the light prematurely.
You really have to trust that process then, don't you?
Oh, you do. Oh, yes, you do. And there are years when I don't write anything good, and that's okay, too. You have to trust that if you sit down and do the work daily, faithfully, someday something good will happen.
One of the other things that strikes me about these stories is there's a lot that is unspoken. You know, the hurt that a woman never shares with her husband, or the boy that hides his genius from numbers from his teachers and his classmates. Is that a Southern thing? Is that a human thing, that hiding?
Yeah, I think it's a human thing. I do. And I think that we all have these internal lives that nobody else gets a glimpse of. And I think that's what makes us beautiful, strange humans. I mean, if you sit down and you actually talk to another person for a long time, a stranger, they will show their weirdness to you so quickly. And the weirdness comes out of this internal life that they have that is not glimpsable unless they allow you to share it. And I think that that's a true, true generosity and beauty of humanity.
Lauren Groff, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you, Virginia.
That is author Lauren Groff. Her latest book of short stories, Florida, is out now. She'll be in Atlanta tomorrow evening for a reading at SCAD Show in Midtown. And you can find details on the event at our website, gpbnews.org. Just ahead, the sounds of the South with folklorist Bill Ferris. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The National Women's Law Center finds women 35% more likely to live in poverty than men. And women are overrepresented in low-paying jobs. Tomorrow on the show, why are women poor? I'd like to include your voice. Is the wage gap affecting you? If so, how? You can leave us a voicemail at 404-500-9457 or find us on Twitter or on Facebook. And then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Southern has a variety of meanings in the personal and popular imagination. It's a term that evokes history and culinary and musical traditions and ways of talking that often get lumped together, especially by those who don't know the South.
I wore my 44 so long till it made my shoulder so, and I do what I want to, ain't gonna wear my 44 no more.
For the last half century, folklorist Dr. William Ferris has used photographs, field recordings, and film to document the true character of the American South. Atlanta-based Dust to Digital is out with a collection of Ferris's interviews, films, and songs, and we're getting a sample of that now. Bill Ferris joins me now from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's Associate Director of the Center for the Study of the American South. Well, I'm told I can call you Bill anyway. Hello.
Hi, Virginia. It's an honor to be with you.
Oh, so lovely to speak with you and to read about your life in the beautiful book accompanying this set. You grew up on Broadacres. This was a farm near Vicksburg, Mississippi. And you describe a childhood that sounds almost idyllic. Give us a sense of what it was like.
Well, it was a very isolated farm 16 miles southeast of Vicksburg, Mississippi, and my family were the only white family on it, and there were six black families, and we worked together. We lived in a very intimate kind of community with a little church that was on the farm. A lady named Mary Gordon would take me to that church as a four-year-old, five-year-old child, and I learned the hymns in that church. And later realized there were no hymnals, and when those families were gone, the music would disappear. So I began as a teenager to record and photograph that church and the worlds around the farm, and that really led me to a career as a folklorist, which this box set represents.
You grew up alongside these families. You mentioned they were descendants of slaves who lived on the farm, but treated as equals by your family. Now, this was in the Jim Crow South. Was your family different in that way?
Looking back on it, they were very different. And I think a key to that difference was education. My parents both were college graduates, and many of my family taught and worked within the academy. My uncle, Parker Hall, was treasurer of the University of Chicago. Another uncle, Eugene Ferris, pioneered the study of medicine and was a professor at Emory University's medical school. And they brought their colleagues, many of them Jewish scholars, to the farm, and the farm really was kind of like a salon during the holiday season. And as children, we grew up very much influenced by those worlds.
Well, let's hear just one of your field recordings. This is Alex Haley, author of Roots, The Saga of an American Family, which has been adapted now into two television miniseries. Here he is describing his love for the South.
In a certain way, I'm influenced in whatever I say by the fact that I innately love the South. I really truly think it's the best place in this country to live. I just feel the South is a place of hands. It's a place of touch, of caress, of less of slapping and knocking people down. It's a softer, sweeter culture.
A softer, sweeter culture. This is one of, thousands of recordings that you made. You later made films. What, to you, Bill Ferris, made them worth, let's say, documenting?
Well, my father, who was a farmer, taught me a lesson. He used to say that you can learn a lesson from every person you meet in life. And I tried to apply that. And whether I was talking to Alex Haley or Eudora Welty or a Parchman prison inmate, I tried to learn from them, and I always did. And recording and photographing and filming those people was my way of preserving their voice and their image for future generations.
Well, here are inmates at the Mississippi Parchman Farm. This is a working prison farm singing the song Waterboy Drowned in the Mobile Bay.
Did you hear, boss?
Oh, yeah.
The waterboy drowned.
Uh-huh.
Did you hear, boss?
Oh, yeah.
The waterboy drowned.
Uh-huh.
The Mobile Bay.
So that's just one of this vast collection. When, Bill, did you become aware of yourself as an archivist or a collector?
Well, it came much later. I tell my students, follow your heart, and you'll be happy and successful. And that's what I did. I loved the farm and the people there, and I didn't want to lose contact. And the early recordings were my way of bonding with those roots. But I had no idea where that would lead. I didn't even know the word folklore. It was much later, as a graduate student, that over breakfast in Ireland, I discovered a scholar who told me that the field of folklore was a way I could do what I loved and get paid for it. So I ended up doing a PhD in folklore at the University of Pennsylvania, and it was during the late 60s as a graduate student that I became aware that there was a field that allowed me to do what I'd been doing since I was a teenager. And to see that preservation as a life's work.
I'm talking with the folklorist Bill Ferris. For more than 50 years, he's been documenting the South through field recordings, photographs, and films. And last week, Atlanta-based Dust to Digital released a collection of these recordings called Voices of Mississippi. Here is a recording that speaks to Southern hospitality. Quilt maker Pecolia Warner, she's telling a story about meeting a white Bible salesman from Texas who asked her for some food that she was making when he came in.
He enjoyed his dinner. He's steak and rice and toast. Then he got up, he said, "Miss Warner, you don't know how I appreciate it." I don't know, last time I used to had a piece of steak. I said, "Just now. That's the last time I had a piece." He said, "You're right." But when he got ready to go back to Texas, he come back here and he asked me about my address, my full name and everything. So he wants to show me how he appreciated when he goes back home. He was going to send me a card.
Now, Bill Ferris, did you just pop in on people with your tape recorder and microphone? I mean, how did you get people to tell your stories and to trust you?
Well, I think of the work I do as a folklorist as not unlike what a psychiatrist does with therapy. People love to talk about themselves. And if they feel you're genuinely interested in their lives, they open up. And then it's just a question of how long. Will it be an hour or 10 years that you have that conversation? And I always felt welcomed into homes of black and white people that I worked with. And that was a special kind of bond that once you start, it becomes a lifetime friendship and relationship, which is something very special about folklore.
You also brought Ray Lum. He was an 84-year-old mule trader from Vicksburg to talk outside of Yale's Sterling Memorial Library. This was, I guess, in 1975. Here's a little bit of that recording.
A trader? Not a T-R-A-I-T-O-R. You ain't talking about that. A T-R-A-D-E-R is a man that trades in everything. And a real trader don't ever find nothing that he can't use. If he can't use it, he'll find somebody else that can. That's his business. You are never broke as long as you keep trading. Keep something to trade on. There's lots of people can take a pocket knife and run it into a barrel of money.
I'm just trying to imagine Ray Lum surrounded by Ivy League students with their mouths agape.
Yes. He shook the foundations of Yale in a very wonderful way. He was seated on the cross campus, which is in front of Sterling Memorial Library. It's the heart of the campus. And throughout the day, he never stopped talking. And the students gathered around him on the steps. And at one point, Bart Giamatti, who was then the chair of the English department, joined me and listened to him. And he said, "You know, Bill, I've listened to Cleanth Brooks, the Faulkner scholar on Yale's faculty, speak often about Faulkner, but I never really understood Faulkner fully until I heard Mr. Lum."
Well, that's the thing. This adds so much to the understanding of the Southern character. But I'm wondering how complicated that is, the idea of studying the American South, you know, reading literature or reading the history, rather than what you've done, conjuring it in original art and books and music.
Well, that's so true. Really, what I was doing is what Faulkner and Richard Wright, Alice Walker, the great writers, have listened to storytellers. And they have taken those narratives and created the great works of fiction like The Color Purple. And so by bringing in Ray Lum literally into the class or through this box set, you come face to face with the voices of the South, who are the true people who shape and define what the culture is all about.
Well, let's hear Alice Walker talking about the importance of place. And this is from a recording at Jackson State University in 1969.
I think I'm dealing with regions inside people. You know, although they are, the people are in the South. And in fact, I guess I really just leave that up to other people to decide. I mean, if they want it, if they can only understand writing by placing it in a context, that's fine. I don't really quarrel with it. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm really trying to understand people and how they get to be the way they are.
Alice Walker there. She became a lifelong friend of yours as well, I believe.
But yes.
Talking about the stories inside of the regions inside of people, and it's interesting because you have done comprehensive recording, as you said, bringing your tape recorder everywhere, no preference for race or class. Now, Alice Walker became a famous author, but you recorded people making music who would never consider themselves to be musicians, maybe, or quilt makers who wouldn't have thought of themselves as artists. So what did your attention to them do?
Well, you cast a bright light on these artists who really don't think of themselves with the word artist. They are making a quilt to keep you warm at night. And Alice Walker has a beautiful short story about just that. There are two sisters who each want a quilt. One of them is going to keep the quilt to cover the bed. The other wants to put it on the wall in a museum and preserve it. But the person who makes the quilt does it as a work that's traditionally handed down in what is called fireplace learning, an apprenticeship of mother to daughter. And the blues, the gospel, all of these traditions are learned through the oral tradition from generation to generation. And they are the voices, like a chorus, that help us frame and understand the American South.
That is the folklorist Bill Ferris. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Virginia. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you. For years, Bill has documented the South through field recordings, and last week, Atlanta-based Dust to Digital released a collection of those recordings. It is called Voices of Mississippi. And we do owe a debt to Chuck Reese, who wrote about William Ferris's work for The Bitter Southerner. We put a link to that article and to more on the Voices of Mississippi collection at gpbnews.org. That's it for our show today, but first, a moment to hear from you. We talked earlier this week about the academic achievement gap that's caused by summer break. Listener Casey Martin left us a comment on Facebook and says, "I would love to have year-round school, and my kids have said they would love it too. Go back to a more old-school style education, too." But Julie Dunham of St. Mary's, Georgia, says summer break isn't such a bad thing. She wrote on Facebook that her kids are burnt out by the end of the school year and need the downtime that summer vacation brings, and adds, quote, "You know who else needs a break? Our underappreciated and overworked teachers. How about instead of working for 7 months every year to prepare our kids for standardized tests, we let educators educate." Thanks so much, Casey and Julie. You can always find us on Facebook or on Twitter at OST Talk, or leave us a message at 404-500-9457. Our show is produced by Fenley Foxen, The Raven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is our senior producer. Susan Davis is our executive producer, and our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Second Thought is a production of Georgia Public Broadcasting.